So today we talk about things on the outside of the supernovae, and talk about possible circumstance interaction around type 1a supernovae. Now I'll mention something about the ways to detect the hydrogen also. Maybe not from the outside, but from the inside actually. So let's go on. So what I'm doing here is to test really the non-conservative mass loss. That is, if you have the binary star system here, and the white dwarf and the donor, and that might be, as Ed talked about on Monday, there could be also mass loss from the system, and that is actually what we're going to test. We're looking at the circumstance interaction, because maybe the supernova explodes, and then in a couple of hours the shockwave has run over the binary star, and it goes out in this presumed wind in this case. So we can see, the wind blows out off, like, of course, it is not really symmetric around the supernova, but it is like symmetric around the donor star. But in a matter of 1 or 2 days, the system is more or less spherically symmetric, or at least point symmetric. We can assume it is spherically symmetric. And then we can use the model we have done for type 2 supernovae or core collapse supernovae. We have a supernova expanding out into a wind, presumed to be an R2-2 wind. And then you have a lot of ionizing radiation coming from this interaction region, where we have a shocked supernova ejecta going, and the shock going into the ejecta, of course, and then we have shocked stellar wind, where the shock goes out in the wind. And the typical velocity is like 20,000, 30,000 kilometers per second, so the temperature of this heated shock in the wind goes to 10 to 9 degrees, and then above that, whereas the temperature in the shocked ejecta could be 10 to 8, or that 10 to 7 degrees. And normally the density is much higher in the shocked ejecta than the shocked wind, so actually you get a lot of emission coming out in the shocked ejecta, mainly free-free emission, and here you can get free-free emission also, but I mentioned more about that. So what happens here is that you produce a lot of ionizing radiation from these shocks, and that, of course, ionizes the wind out here, and it's not a time-dependent phenomenon, so it takes time for Strömgren sphere to go out into the wind. So you will have a region of ionized hydrogen here, or ionized wind, and you have a neutral region out here.
The picture with the neutral wind and ionized wind, if in fact the progenitor is a superstar, then it's been emitting highly ionizing radiation over a very long time,
Like 5 to 7 years. Right.
And so we actually don't see many
of
these, but in principle, you could ionize material out to several parsecs, even more than 10 parsecs.
It is not. We looked at that in 1996 together with Robert Cumming in a paper, and it turns out that the mass loss rate has to be 10 to minus 9 solar masses per year or something like that. If it's above that, the recombination time is long enough to establish like an H2 region inside and very close to the star. So the wind is not ionized in that case. You have a very small region close to the star, which is ionized maybe, but not the full wind in that case.
So you're saying that analyzing the existing data on supernovae, ruling out the fact that it couldn't be ionized?
Well, this comes out from the modeling. If you have, I have some pictures of that, not with me, but if you look at, In the model we have, we know what ionizing radiation is produced by this shockwave going out. We have done modeling for that. And also, if the mass loss rate is below 10 to minus 9 solar masses per year, then it's true, then the precursor can have pre-ionized the wind. But if the mass loss rate is higher, there's no, and the recombination times are so short compared to the ionization, so that there will not be an ionized wind.
So you're saying that even though the whole region into which the around this source could be ionized, the wind itself will not be ionized.
That's right. Well, if the wind is not ionized, the photons don't reach out further either. Unless they're very, very, very hard in that case. If you have 10 keV photons like that, then they request they blow out through the wind as well, so they can ionize the gas outside. But that is not an important source for this one I'm talking about right now. It's far too little emission coming out from these sources to ionize the wind for what we are looking at right now here.
No.
So, in principle, you you will have some kind of stronger radius here, but of course it goes out very quickly if you have a prompt emission from the supernova. But as I show later on, prompt emission is not an important source either for these things. It's like the most important source of an ionization comes from the shock, actually. So what we did here is just to apply models, what we did for type 1, type 2 supernovae, and type 1 BC supernovae, and it stems from papers by Roger Chevalier and Klaus and me. And we have done what Roger did first was look at self-similar solutions here, where you have the contact discontinuity between the two shocks, the reverse shock and the forward shock, and the density is higher here on the inside than the outside here. And this region being much smaller also. The masses are roughly comparable for the, if you assume that the ejector has a density slope of R to minus N, and the succinylic gas has R to minus 2, and N being 7 roughly for a model like W7 or any type 1A supernova, then the ejector mass the shock mass here becomes roughly the same as here, but the region is much more extended, the density much, much lower here. So if you look at calculations for the temperature and density here, and this is the density and the temperature here, goes up to about 10 to 10 degrees or something. This is made for 1993 J, which is a bit slower than normal type 1A supernova, but we have roughly the same parameters in this case. So then temperature goes up to 10 to 10 degrees here, and here goes up maybe to a few times 10 to 8, maybe 10 to 9. But what's really important is to look at the electron temperature here, which if you don't invoke, I mean, unknown plasma instabilities and so on, the temperature here would not be the same, maybe an order of magnitude lower for the electrons here than ions. Whereas in the reverse shock here, the temperatures are roughly the same. You see a slight deviation from equal temperatures also. So look at what happens here from the emission from these shocks here, that you get the free emission from both the reverse shock here and the forward shock. And since the forward shock here, even if it is not full equipartition between temperatures, the forward shock is hotter than the reverse shock, so you get harder photons coming out here from this. But the density is lower, so you don't get as much emission from the forward shock as the reverse shock. So even if the temperatures are not equal in the forward shock, the reverse shock will dominate the emission from this gas. If the temperature will be the same in the forward shock, then it becomes, I mean, of course, harder photons, but it doesn't change the situation very much. You'll have most emission coming from the reverse shock anyway. So that is the most important, I mean, ionizer of this wind in this case. So I listed a few possible sources here that can ionize. Then you have free emission from the shock ejector, which is important here then. From the circumstellar gas, it's not so important, but not so important. You have also photospheric emission and inverse Compton scattering. Of course, you have a lot of photons coming out from the supernova, and they then scatter in the hot shock circumstellar gas, and that produces a tail of this photon in the photon spectrum here, like a power law to the photospheric emission, and that can be important. The problem is that we don't really know so much about the temperature here in the forward shock. So I've listed two examples here. One will have the temperatures are just heated by Coulomb collisions, and here like the same temperature of ions and electrons, and that makes a huge difference in the contribution from the inverse Compton scattering of the photospheric photons. Prompt emission from the shock breakout has been discussed quite much as a possible source, but I mean, mind you, this it's a very, very tiny object here. And if you remember from 87A, which has a few times 10 to 12 centimeters, and here is like much smaller, so it's a very short burst, maybe 1 second of 10 to 6 Kelvin photons. That will not be important for the outbreak here. So that, but it's important for the
Can you elaborate a little on that? Why?
Yes, count the number of photons. That's yes. Which then could ionize promptly from something. But the recombination time scales are days, maybe less than that, in the inside. So the gas will quickly recombine again. So that's not really important for what we see there. So what is important is that a continuous input of ionizing photons so it can ionize the wind ahead of the shock wave.
So is the recombination time that makes prolonged emission more important than bursts in this particular?
Yes, I mean, you need to have like a prolonged emission to generate them and a continuous ionization.
But
I mean, if the density of the wind is very low, of course, then it's enough to ionize the wind You'll have to look at the recombination timescales in that case. And also the reactive input and precursor emission, as I said before, are not so important. So what is important is the ejecta emission and also then the inverse Compton scattering, which is a bit tricky to calculate. But so in most cases, what I'll discuss later on, I've just like either omitted completely, or I just have some parameters for it. So this is like what you have from the outset, of course, but we need also to look at the observations to get it into a full picture to say something about how fast the shock wave goes out into the surface matter to say something about this. And if you look at observations, we looked at the several supernovae, and we see that, I mean, the fastest ejecta of these go up to almost 40,000 kilometers per second. And looking here, this was supernova 84A, 1990N, and 2001EL, with a paper by Mattila. And we looked at that, and we came up lost this of this order. It means that the ejecta velocity must be at least 45,000 kilometers per second. And in this model, what I showed before, it means that this ejecta mass stays very high because in this case the time only has 10 t to minus 0.2 in this case. So we have a fast shock moving out and overtaking this dense region of matter very quickly. So if you have a dense matter close to supernova, you have to be very quick to see this H alpha emission, otherwise it is too late. So looking at this then, how do we do the modeling here? Now, we, as I said before, we calculated the emission from the Earth shock, and in some models I also included the photospheric emission, which produces a small tail then from Blinnikov and Sorokina. And including the models for the Earth shock, I used both the same temperature for electrons and ions, and also used the temperature which is lower for electrons then. And then we calculated everything, the ionization structure of the unshocked gas then time-dependently, including a lot of elements here. And then most elements are treated as multi-level atoms. And then you calculate the emission of the escaping ion photons afterwards. So that's showing one example of what can come out from this. Sorry, Pete. you can see here that if you look at the temperature, what's important here if you want to look at the emission from the in the wind is that, of course, the lines will be very narrow. The winds are like 10 kilometers per second, maybe 50 kilometers per second or something like that. But it doesn't really matter because what will dominate mainly is for H alpha is the thermal broadening of the lines. And since it's quite high temperatures, and the temperature here is like I've done a simulation showing here what the luminosity weighted temperature is for the winds, for different mass loss rates here for the wind, going from 10 to minus 6 solar masses per year up to 10 to minus 4 solar masses, 5 solar masses per year here. In all these cases, the luminosity weighted temperature of H alpha is like 30,000 degrees, 28,000 degrees. So it means that thermal broadening of the lines are important, more important actually than the line widths from the wind. So even though you need a Schell spectrograph probably to see this, you don't have to go to the highest resolution to see it because of the thermal broadening of the lines. So it seems also to stay rather constant, regardless of the temp of the mass loss rate of the wind here.
By the
reverse shock, yeah, continuously.
By the ionization from the reverse shock.
It heating by the reverse shock, and that produces an ionization front. And in between the reverse shock and that's the gas you get the emission from. That is at 40 kilometers per second, something like that, or that was 30, 40 kilometers per second. So it's not really the lowest. I mean, like you go into 7 kilometers per second, you have for VLTUs, for instance. You don't need that high resolution, really. You would need it if you have metal lines, of course, but for hydrogen and helium, it's not so important. If you also look at other wavelengths, not just the emission from the optical lines, we'll come back to that more. You look at also the X-ray emission coming out here. So here you have this X-ray spectra from reverse shock here. And this, the dashed line is what actually is produced by the reverse shock. What then happens is that the wind carves out quite much of this emission. So you have absorption of photons below 1 keV roughly. So the only thing you see is our photons above 1 keV. And that, of course, decreases with time from as the reverse shock propagates out, less and less emission is produced, so it goes down. As this showed here, this is a mass loss right here, assuming a wind of 10 kilometers per second. And I also calculate the models where you have extreme helium to hydrogen ratios here, 1 in this case, so it doesn't matter so much what the abundance is really in the CSM. You get roughly the same behavior anyway of the spectrum coming out here. There is one observation being done by 92A, by Schlegel et al., I think it is, and they, Schlegel and Petri, and they have estimated the mass loss rate of 10 to minus 6, or mass P or something. They used the wrong time, unfortunately. They took the day, I mean, the time after peak, not time after explosion, but they should have done in the Rogers model. So that means, and also have revised it a bit, so it means that the mass loss rate is not 10 to minus 6, it's 2 times 10 to minus 5 roughly mass loss rate limit for that. So it's very high. I mean, you know, what would you expect maybe to see around type 1As?
And if the upper velocity is higher, then you would get even
higher. Well, I mean, I think they used roughly the same velocities for the shock. Yeah.
Everyone uses 10 kilometers.
Yeah.
That's like the standard.
Yeah.
But if you
get... yes, if you have a high velocity, then it goes down. I mean, of course, that's what it goes up the mass loss rate limit, I'm sure. Yeah, well, that's it. I think that's a core collapse community doing this. So, I mean, if you, of course, and it goes up. Yeah. 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 Like, well, Fourier stars is out of the question in this case, of course, but yeah. It could be 50, it could be maybe 80 or 100, but 1,000, I don't think. I mean, like, you know.
Yeah,
I presume. Yeah. The whole idea is to test just the non-conservative mass loss, no matter what the system is, actually. So, and we have now new observations also of 2002 BO. It's a paper by Jack Hughes. And we have looked at that one, and we have done similar modeling. The red curves here are models from me, and the black models here are modeled from Nikolai Shugai. We put in modeling in and both models in the same, in these upper limits done for 2002 BO. And regardless of which model we use, actually we come up with the same result. Again, 10 to minus 5 solar masses per year, even for that one also, for 10 kilometers per second wind.
How early is that observation?
This is very early. I mean, it was... I forgot exactly the date now, but I can look it up. I mean, it's quite early.
It seems that the more carefully you try to model this, the more conservative the limits.
Yeah.
Get.
Well,
as they go up, they don't go down.
That's true, because I mean, if now inverse Compton scattering would be very important in this case here now, then you have this tail of photons at 1 keV, which could shoot, I mean, it could lower the limit if you believe that's the case, to be down to 10 to minus 6 in that case. But this is so uncertain, so I just omitted it. These are conservative limits. I mean, if we look at this in a refined way.
It's very interesting,
yeah.
Because a lot of people are very fond of, you know, seeing the number down and down,
yeah.
And down.
I'm shooting that down completely. I come more to that. Oi, I had this time to explain, perhaps. If you look at the optical near infrared lines, then I made lots of models that you can see here, and don't matter look to so much in the detail here, but what you should look at is like the mass loss rates scale here, and this is the luminosity here. And for various models, I don't have to go into details what they only show here, but you can look at the text here later on the web if you wish. But what's most important is that for all these models, starting 10 to minus 7 solar masses per year, going up to 10 to minus 5, so these are the model predictions. This is actually observations of, in this case, SN2000CX. And you only cross the lines around 10 to minus 5 solar masses here also. So for optical emission, we don't go deeper in that case than the X-rays. We do get roughly the same results, 10 to minus 5 solar masses per year. And this is at quite early, I mean, it's before maximum. You have to go back to very early observations. So this is before maximum. And despite that, you don't see very much. And if you look at the other lines, like helium 1 here, 5876, helium 10, 830, helium 2, 4686, they are not, they won't help you very much, unless you have a wind which consists of mainly helium, and then you should look for them with 10830, because that produces roughly the same emission as the H alpha in that case. This model is for higher helium abundance here. This is just to show what happens with time, 10 days and 15 days and 64 days and 95 days. Of course, the flux goes down from the various lines. Fortunately, we have a very long exposure we took in the archive, 85 days, and that produces roughly the same limit as the early epochs here. 10 to minus 5 solar masses appear roughly. It's a kind of negative, of course, but that's, well, we tried at least to do our best in this case. So we launched like campaigns on both the VLT on Subaru to try to see optical emission from these old epochs we had data from. And the best examples are 2001 EL and 2000 CX. We have to go to very early times, because this is like a plot I show here, how far down you can go in mass loss rate, perhaps, depending on how early you are. So this has curves for 10 to minus 5, and 5 times 10 to minus 6 solar masses per year. So these curves shoot up very much the earlier you get. So it's the detection limit here. So if you go to this the detection limits here, you could, in principle, if you go down to maybe only a few days after explosion, go down to 10 to minus 6 solar masses per year. But that's really, really tough. I mean, you have to find the supernova when it's so faint, and you have to be on a telescope very quickly. So, I mean, a practical limit is a few times 10 to minus 6. You wouldn't see anything else in optical emission from this. This just to show you some results here for 2000 CX. Around the different epochs, here is the data. And there's no emission lines there. Helium lines, same thing, I don't see anything. That's very early observations, minus 6 days and so on. That didn't help, of course. 2001 EL, the same thing. We have looked at early data also. Long exposures with the VLT UBIS mass loss rate limit. For this one, it's probably the best one we got so far. It's at 9 times 10 to minus 6 solar masses per year. Again, it scales with the velocity of the wind, of course. Yeah, well, you can expect roughly 100 times higher up. Yeah, but I mean 1,000. I would not. Yeah, you can accommodate anything you want in there, more or less. But I guess you shouldn't be expect 1,000 from a second. I mean, in that case. Okay, people have looked in other wavelength regions, not only optical and X-rays. And here is a survey done by Panagia and Kurt Weil et al. And they have just adopted Roger Chevalier's model from 1983, like a free absorption in the wind. And they have scaled emission from known supernova, like other supernovae so have a fast ejector, like 1Bs and 1Cs. And they come up with mass loss rate limits of the order 10 to minus 8 or 7 solar masses per year. It's a different ballpark here. Maybe you come into different ballpark with the big collecting radio telescopes. So, I mean, here, it is the most sensitive wavelength region is to go to the radio. That's obvious. But I think you have to be kind of careful when you just adopt emission from other supernovae like that. And to look into that in more detail, we launched another program down on ATCA in Australia and to look at this. And we have also some data, archival data, we looked into the model here. And I think it is fair to say that we have probably probed down to 10 to minus 7 solar masses per year from the radio. We have to be a bit careful here. We are still working on the modeling here because there are some intricate things here, like you have Compton cooling of photons of electrons around the shock, forward shock, and so on, that could produce dips in the emission and so on. So I had to be careful. But I think 10 to minus 7 is a fair limit roughly from radio so far. We can probably probe a little bit deeper there. Yeah.
Time period would that have to be taking place?
This is assuming the wind is all the way into like 10 to 13, 14 centimeters. I mean, where the binary star companion is, more or less.
So
a continuous wind. Right, right. Because you need this continuous input from the shock to ionize the gas outside. Otherwise, it will recombine and you won't see it. But there are other cases I'll come back to also. But, so for the only type of super display lines here, the X-ray and X-ray have not been successful to see this beam. We have observations in X-rays, now also the paper with Jack Hughes, of both 2002 IC and 2005 GEJ, and we have here only upper limits again. Now this model is the same model as Nikolai Shugai worked out together with the co-workers. It just at the limit of what we should have detected probably. We have to invoke extra cooling or an absorption of the photons from the forward shock in this case to be able to have emission lower than the upper limit. So we are probably at the limit of detecting these things. Now it's too late, I think, but this time it was observed quite early. And look at the optical spectrum here, you see, the clear detections of H-alpha here and other lines, of course, also. Calcium 2 and so on. So that there are circumstances when you do see the optical lines, but not the radio and the X-rays. Because here, the radio and X-rays are heavily absorbed by the circumpolar shell in this case, maybe 0.3 solar masses of gas sitting out there, absorbing the gas completely. Whereas the optical emission here is... Let's say two clear cases, and then I can move to the two clear cases, those two, and then also suspected cases from 97 CY and 99 E, if they were type 1A supernovae. There are claims that all of these class are not type 1As at all. I mean, there's a paper recently by Benetti et al. Saying that they are not type 1As, or maybe Massimo knows more about that. So that it is still. It's still a difficult thing.
Is that also 2005 JC is not
DJ.
DJ.
No.
It's not the type 1A we are working on.
I saw a paper recently about that. I didn't have time to read it, but...
On GJ, we are still working.
Aha, I see.
On 2002
IC.
We're convinced that 2005 GJ was a 1A.
These were star-forming galaxies, right?
Yeah, multiply star-forming
radio. So what is that controversy about then? What convinces you that it is and you that it's not?
We are playing, perhaps I can talk about this during my presentation 10 days from now. Anyway, the problem, the point for being a type 1A is that there is some silicon in the earliest spectra. The silicon line. So, and Maria Mui and collaborators published a paper in which they say that the early spectrum was a combination of a spectrum like 91T, peculiar type 1A, plus a continuum, probably due to the interaction. We played with other objects instead of type 1As, some type 1C, which show we have a much better match, not much better, a better match. It's still a possibility what we say. But in this way, we don't have any problems in interpreting all the observables.
I must say one thing. I had a director's application in at HST to look at that, actually, in silicon lines and so on. It didn't go through, unfortunately, but I think we have settled that problem otherwise. Then.
I mean, you mentioned that there are compared to other sectors as well, but we find an excellent match with mainland T.
I don't say that the match is not good. I say that the match is good also, or even better, with some type 1C. And in this case, everything comes much more natural, even because you say there is an indication that it is a star-forming region, and you don't
Yeah, you expect a wind from a massive progenitor, so the, it's less...
But what else is observed from this one? Well, light curves? What is known? It's not just the spectra, you can take other criteria from to distinguish between 1C and 1A.
The light curves, especially in this 2005 JC, it has a sort of peak, and then the light curve is very broad because it's interacting. It becomes a type 2N supernova, just to say shortly.
But the only thing I can think of is you have to throw off this material very recently in that case from the type 1C. I mean, you don't have any hydrogen helium in there. So you must have thrown it off quite recently in that case to have it like a type 1C supernova in that case, unless it comes from the companion star. But if it comes from the progenitor itself, it must have been thrown off quite recently. So it's a huge coincidence, I guess, to have it close to the supernova in that case.
We have other strange objects, a very recent one, like, I don't remember the name, 2006 JEY, these LBV-related objects,
which the
coincidence should be much more strange to justify, but yes.
Of course, I can be fully detected by
Oh, no. Wolfgang
remembers the early detection of 2000 CX. Yeah. So,
going back to your previous one,
okay.
Whether or not it's a 1A or not, what's the upper limit on the mass loss rate you get for your non-detection?
I think it's like not mass loss rate, it's like a shell of a matter, like of 0.3 solar masses. So it's like a heavy, it's a fairly distinct shell out there. That's what it is. And then the mass loss rate, 10 to minus 2, 3. Three, I mean, like another complete region, 10 times higher than for core collapse supernovae. But the highest we have, it was 79C has a 10 to minus 4. This is like at least 10 times higher than that. So it's really, really like an opaque shell. Okay, let us go to some other complete shifting gears completely here now, looking for hydrogen at later stages instead. And look at here models done by Yvonne Marietta, Fixell, and Burrows. And they have looked at a binary star sitting close to the white dwarf, of course. And the white dwarf explodes, and it sends a shock wave out here, and ejecta hits the star and blows off a fat chunk of the star. But it sends also a shock wave into the star, and the star is heated up, and it is then evaporated off here. So I can see if this moves really works here. So the shockwave comes in here and heat up the star, and there's the evaporation coming out here from the star as well afterwards. And this evaporation is the velocity of this evaporated wind coming off from the star is in no case higher than 10 to 3 kilometers in their modeling here. So 1,000 kilometers per second is roughly what comes out. So what we played with this was just to take them, of course, and this will not be seen early on because the supernova ejecta will shield this very much. So you have to wait until later times to see this. So, and to do this, we use the same model as was used in the COSMA paper together with Wolfgang. 2005, where they tested the Munich group explosion models here. We were a little bit more modest. We used W7 here in our modeling here, and then it took that and included various amounts of mass of solar abundance material inside the innermost 10 to 3 kilometers per second and see what happened here. This is just the models here from the COSMA paper. I show that it is quite close to reality. I guess what can we tell much more about that later on. So what we did here is to look at, this is the observed spectrum 2000 CX, roughly 1 year after the explosion here. And we have inserted this various amounts of material, of solar rich material in here. This is for 0.01 solar mass material, the lowest curve here. It's like, look at around H alpha, of course, done. 0.01 solar masses. Here is 0.05 solar masses of hydrogen, which does not at all match the model. So you would have seen this clearly in this case. So an upper limit roughly is 0.03, I would say, solar masses that you can accept to have inside inside the star. We did on the same thing for 98BU. It works out that they come up to roughly the same limit again, 0.03. It depends on the data and so on. We have also 2001 EL, the same modeling. Here maybe you have an even better limit, 0.02, but then say 0.02, 0.03 solar masses of solar-rich material. In that way, yeah. Right. Well, should go back to the draw board in process. Anyway, so I mean, you can allow to have 0.02, 0.03 solar masses of hydrogen in there, but not more. I guess it will be seen otherwise. I think.
Now, these are independent of the modeling you did earlier, right?
Yeah, this is completely different. This is a late time spectrum, and the completely different code here. The code was the same as Cecilia Cosmal developed for 87A and other supernovae. And used it together with Wolfgang for his models also.
Can I understand this a little bit better?
Yeah.
It looks like a nice clean limit that's going to actually be pretty constraining. So I'm not sure I understand it. Yeah. So where
have
you put it?
We put it uniformly within the 10 to 3 kilometers per second. I mean, like uniform hydrogen solar abundance material inside there, inside the 10 to 3 kilometers per second region. Yeah, for this epoch, I mean, for 1 year epoch roughly.
Right. So. And that's because you put it there because that's the expectation from the simulation.
Right.
Where the hydrogen
you blow off that from the companion star. So.
Right. These numbers are 0.01. Was this from a main sequence star?
That's a main sequence. That doesn't really matter so much because the point that we just plugged in. I mean, what they came up with.
Doesn't matter for this, but from the simulations that are
edited. They have no models lower than 0.15 solar masses. No model. I mean, whatever they have, no model less than 0.15. So it constrains a lot, actually, in this case.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is the neatest result we've done so far. So now at 0.03 solar masses, roughly here. So and they actually said that you should look out in the infrared because it's cleaner area to look at maybe passion alpha and passion beta. We did that also, but it is a messy region to observe, of course. So what we came up with, to truncate a bit here, but. I think 0.5 solar masses you can accept almost from the infrared. When the data are not good enough to be constraining. So that you should not look in the infrared. You should look at the long exposures or whatever.
So what about
I know, but we looked at we used solar abundance material and we looked at what lines would you expect to see in this case, and we haven't looked for helium yet. I mean, that is. I don't think that'll change very much. You see, the lines we looked at putting in, this is only 0.01 and 0.05, 0.10 and 0.5 solar masses per year. And the lines that start to shoot up, it is H-alpha. We have calcium-2 also coming up a bit here. If it's solar abundance material. I don't think the limits will change very much for helium, I mean, in that case. So you become, I can't say a limit for that, but I don't think it'd be 0.15, I think maybe 0.05 or whatever, but they don't point 0.15, I think, no, we can't come up with.
Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, if I wanted to escape this constraint,
yeah.
Though it doesn't give me a good type 1A, the old building in sequence are very compact
object,
in which case I would imagine, but I don't know yet, it did be calculations, but I think that's an even harder system to get material off of.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's much more highly balanced. So, there is the question is what's the wiggle room that's remaining?
Okay.
And I just don't know the answer for that.
So we can do that, no problem this time. No.
Lars, are the hydrogen numbers limits on the total mass of the companion?
Or this is the mass?
Yeah, I understand, but in terms of what percentage of the mass of the companion do you already see in the atmosphere? Do you have some wiggle room saying, well, it only pulled out 5% of the mass of the companion, so therefore.
I mean, I would imagine if it's a red giant, that they have,
they did the giant. Yeah, there's more. Yeah.
Huge
yeah.
Going on.
So it's a 0.5 or something like that. So.
If you take it seriously, it really does go out.
No.
It really is most of the mass.
So. I must say also that. No.
Yeah, it's a lot
of problems. No. Also, we use 10 to 3 kilometers per second. That's a conservative limit because in most cases, they have lost it. 300 kilometers a second, so that to shoot up more like a narrow line in that case. But these are actually conservative limits in that case because.
What is the pinball line? close fire, you're seeing this workflow overflow, let's say, in the standard, the co-fire and supersoft source model, and then planning is really close.
They did.
What
if you said, okay, this they did model for that also.
And the companion could be a giant, but it's very far away. Is that covered? I mean, the
yeah.
Distances?
Yeah, they covered that too. I said 0.15 is the lowest limit they come out from their modeling, regardless. I mean, they looked at further away.
Yeah. Giant
in most cases, about 0.3, maybe 0.5, maybe so 0.15.
Your upper limits are typically 0.02.
I say 0.03, I mean, yeah. I would say that.
Yeah.
So let's come to the conclusion here.
Maybe the merger makes you a nice type of
thing. None of this is good news.
we can go to the latest one, the last one first, because I mean that's the point that we just discussed. And I said the limit may be 0.03, so I might appear. I think one that has been overlooked in general, and people doing model spectrum, and one should look at the impurities from the binary companion also into these models, and that could be some effect of that also. I mean, there's some material high velocities that also is thrown off. So I think one maybe should look at this bit impurities of hydrogen-rich material in there to see, I mean, what can it be. I mean, some people have looked at that. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be so important because, I mean, at these epochs, I mean, the radioactive material sits quite far out, so it heats up the matter more locally. So, but just to have a look at it, I guess, it's interesting.
What if you had the hydrogen material there in a very, either in a clumpy structure or not put in uniformly?
Mm.
What would that change? Would it make it more obvious or?
Yeah, I think it would be go up a little bit actually, because then you heat it. I mean, the high density also. Uh-huh. I think these limits are conservative, actually, in this sense. So I think that this could be interesting to look at them, and people do model spectra to include some solar material, rich material, also see what it comes out. A bit less optimistic is, of course, that no emission has been seen from normal type 1A supernovae, and the best limits are from radio and at 10 to minus 7, roughly. And there are these hypothetical type 1A supernovae, then I might say, and I think they are type 1A, but this we have an argument about that. But no radio and X-rays were detected from this because of the heavy absorption in the circular shell. And another thing is that the shells seem to be asymmetric, that there are now mounting evidence for that, polarization and line profiles. I know that Nikolai Shugai argued that they were not asymmetric before, but now he actually came up with a model together with Roger Chevalier about a mild asymmetric model for type 1A 2002 IC also. So I think there are slightly asymmetric winds, which is understandable if you have a binary companion and a focus field and so on. Okay.
Would that actually appear as being type 1A? And some of the discussion we've been having here makes me wonder if it might not look like a type 1A, even though the physical mechanism was the same.
If you have no wind, is that what?
No, I'm just saying, suppose you had a type 1A supernova occur in a region that had a lot of material around it,
mm-hmm.
So a lot of interaction with circumstellar material.
Yeah.
Is there any way you could model that circumstellar material that would cause both the light curve and the spectrum to deviate from the standard type 1A so that you might not pick that up as a type 1A when you're...
I think those 2002 IC and 2005 GJA are exact those examples. I mean, you expand the type 1A into very heavy CSM around it, and then you see, I mean, like... a veiled type 1A under the explosion.
Maybe you're suspicious. That sounds like a type 1A. Mm.
You
made it.
No.
Because
the direction is that anything you grow up in a hydrogen bubble looks like a type 2A, no matter what is underneath.
Mm-hmm. So the is anyone missing things though? You know, you go out there and you're
looking for that. But I guess you would see those in the surveys.
They're buried in that height.
No.
It doesn't seem to be any intermediate thing. They're either really clean or, or very dry.
Right, right. So I think that's the real point, that the standard 1A doesn't have a lot of circumstellar stuff. It just doesn't. There are these special cases that are kind of interesting, but they cannot be the usual thing seen from some angle or something like that. These are really quite unusual.
That's interesting. Yeah. The other question was something that Ed, I think, was trying to get at, the question about winds, and that I was trying to get at the question about ionization states. Has anybody done a model where you take seriously the supersoft source progenitor model, where you have this object maybe losing even more, maybe 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year over some period of time, and to the minus 7 for others. But over a period of maybe 10 to the 7 years, this progenitor has been bathing the surroundings in, you know, highly ionizing radiation, maybe 100 eV type radiation, and sending off a wind. When this matter comes off, it comes off very fast. So maybe thousands of kilometers per second. Would those, if you tried to model that as the condition of the material around it, driven, you know, affected by wind, so you may have a cavity around it, also highly ionized with very high ionization states, if somebody started with that as the initial conditions, would that change many of these results? What's your feeling about that? And would that be worth modeling?
But I think what we did was to assume a 10 to 6 Kelvin spectrum symbiotic star. We looked at that, and the wind was not ionized at mass loss rates above 10 to minus 9 solar masses per year. It was not neutral, but it was not ionized. So, I mean, we looked at that in 1996, we were becoming, and it has not, I mean, you have to go to lower mass loss rates, and those you cannot see, I mean, from any detection limit we have right now.
But so all of the circumstellar material could be ionized, but the wind itself would not be ionized.
Well, the wind and circular material is roughly the same thing. The wind, it is not ionized, but it's very hard photons. The photons might leak out ahead of the wind anyway. Like, to have it 10 to 6 degrees is quite high temperature. So you leak out some high energy photons out there. And over a long period of time, it may be that they still ionize the medium around it. But I think we have a region quite low ionization degree and close to the system because of the high densities in this case. So you have like an inverted structure.
It ionizes by a recombined factor.
Yes. So it's more like a steady state. It's a steady state situation.
The concern means is that there is already a region around it which has been pre-ionized by this progenitor for 100,000.
I don't care about the supernova in this case. I look at the progenitor only. We looked at that before, and assuming a 10 to 6 degree, I mean, spectrum roughly from this star, it doesn't ionize the wind completely unless you have a wind which is a density which is higher than 10 to minus 9 solar masses per year. And if you look at the density, it's more or less a steady state situation. You have like a density structure around it. If it is 10,000, it doesn't matter that the gas doesn't move so fast. It's like it is a steady state situation. You can look at it with any code, I guess.
So you're saying it wouldn't matter if you had a region of 10 parsecs around it, which contains maybe more mass than the wind. And all of that has been ionized because, as Ed was saying, you have this over 10 to the 7 years, you have a region for which the Straubing sphere is very large. So the calculation shows could be, you know, 10 parsecs or so.
If you cut out the wind, that's true. But if you don't cut out the wind, they absorb the photons from the star. So don't reach the 10 parsecs like this.
So you're saying that if you have a source, like a super soft source, and it's in this region, and the calculations that Eugene Chang and other people have done would apply to it, that was only the case when there's no wind.
Yeah.
But if there's a wind, then you have to start over again, and that's essentially what you have done.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I looked at that also, and I looked at the prompt emission as well, and I haven't published that yet, but we will maybe soon open.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because in fact we don't see these ionization
that
differ answer. So that's one out of 5,000.
But we do see partly ionized middle ground type 1As, something like this Carlos maybe would say, that we have them, it's not, that doesn't expand out into completely neutral material. I mean, like you have just like partly ionized material out there. And I talked to Parvis Gavamian about that also, he did some estimates together with me and so on, and we came up with them. The burst has no influence on this, so it must be something else that have produced this.
Yeah, the Balmer shocks that Kelly talked about. In order to have a Balmer shock, you need the medium to be mostly neutral.
But you do need some ionization.
Yeah.
You do need some ionization.
And that may be done by hard photons in this case, produce this spectrum.
Well, of course, it's hard to read a book on if you do, the winds you might imagine would be, you know, bipolar, maybe even jet-like. And the radiation is being, you know, is going into a field all around the system.
Right.
And so, you know, there should be some regions where you have ionization. Like for Calion 7, which is another one of these sources, the emission that we get all comes from lineage. Mm. So that's sort of re-emission from ionized material around the system. Now, I'm not saying that these are necessarily the detectors, but I'm just wondering how strong the constraints are.
Another thing that you would not have, if you had this continuous outflows for thousands of years, for millions of years before the explosion, is a remnant. Because you blow a huge bubble. And the density is next to nothing.
No.
So you said, are you on the same